Today on the 21st, we talk pregnancy and maternal health. Why are C-section rates so different from one hospital to the next?
The biggest thing is honestly the culture. It really has to do with what the mechanisms are in that hospital to deal with high-volume patients and what happens when they get crowded and how the doctors assess situations.
And Sarah Ladipo-Manyika's latest book tells the story of a 70-something-year-old Nigerian woman and the colorful life she leads.
I was finding so many interesting, flamboyant older women in real life, but I wasn't seeing them on the page. I always paraphrase Toni Morrison when she says, if there are stories that you want to read but you can't find them, then you must write them.
She joins us, but first, as we do every Monday, we'll bring you the latest in Illinois politics. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Across the U.S., roughly one out of every three babies are born via C-section. That's more than 1 million babies each year. This procedure, of course, can be life-saving, but researchers estimate that nearly half of the C-sections performed in the U.S. aren't needed, which pose added risks to mother and child. A new investigation from Consumer Reports uncovers another finding about C-sections that may surprise you. A woman's risk of having a C-section can be more than 9 times higher depending on the hospital she chooses. The investigation looks at data for first-time low-risk mothers across the U.S. In Illinois, the chance of a C-section for these women is just below the national average. It's about 1 in 4, but again, that risk varies dramatically depending on the hospital. I'm joined now by the journalist behind that new report, Tara Haley. She's a freelance health reporter based in Peoria. Also joining us on the line from Chicago, Dr. Maura Quinlan is the Illinois chair of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Tara, Dr. Quinlan, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tara, the data you looked at was for first-time low-risk mothers, and you found up to a 9-fold difference, as I was just explaining. Even different hospitals in the same neighborhood could have vastly different rates. What do you think is behind this?
There's a couple of different things going on. The rate that we're looking at is for first-time moms who are having single children, so not multiples, and the child's head is in the head-down position, and they're at full term. They're at least 38 weeks along. And most of the women in those circumstances should have a very low rate of C-sections. It won't be zero because emergencies happen and there are women who would have other conditions such as gestational diabetes or preeclampsia. But for the most part, that there should be a very low rate among that population. But what happens is in the hospital, a couple of different things can really change that. And the biggest thing is honestly the culture. It really has to do with what the mechanisms are in that hospital to deal with high volume patients and what happens when they get crowded and how the doctors assess situations. Two of the biggest contributors to the C-section rates are not actually what a lot of people think they are, which, a lot of people think it's, oh, mothers are unhealthy and, that's increasing it. And that's not the big culprit. The big culprits are heart rate monitors for babies because they're very easily misinterpreted and they have a very low accuracy rate. And the second thing is perceptions of how quickly labor is progressing. So there's a term called labor dystocia, which means stalled labor. And if a woman truly is stalled in her labor, she truly may need an emergency C-section, but that's a subjective measure. And women's, the labor curves that we used to use long ago don't necessarily apply to the same population today. Women labor longer today than they used to. So when you put all those factors together, that's why you have such dramatic rates. It's going to depend on what's happening in that hospital. A lot of hospitals that use midwives have lower rates, and hospitals where the doctors share their rates will have lower rates because, hey, doctors are competitive. They don't want to be the one with the highest rates. But none of that is to say that there aren't reasonable variations. Here in Peoria, where I am, two of the biggest hospitals are OSF St. Francis and Unity Point Methodist. OSF has a 28.3%. Unity Point has a 21.2%. But OSF, which is where I delivered my child, they have one of the largest ICUs in the state, and they are explicitly for high-risk pregnancies, which I was. So I'm still going to choose to deliver there because they cater to the kind of needs that I had, even though they had a higher rate, which makes sense when you consider some of the population. Whether it should be that high at 28% is, it really, that's up for debate.
Yeah, Tara, while we're talking about this, which hospitals had some of the lowest rates?
The three hospitals that had the lowest rates were Little Company of Mary Hospital and Health Care Centers in Evergreen with 10%, Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana, 11%, and Vista Medical Center East, Waukegan, at 11%. I should caution, those are really low rates, and we don't have a solid number on what's like the ideal C-section rate. That's almost an impossible number to pin down, and it's going to vary geographically by population and other things. But these rates are lower than what we would probably expect a national healthy rate to be when you don't see poor outcomes from infants. You have to track the infants at the same time you're tracking the moms to make sure that you're not sacrificing one problem for another.
Right. And before we get into all of that, Dr. Quinlan, I wondered if you could weigh in on what Tara was talking about. I know you've actually just stepped away from teaching residents to have this conversation with us. And I wonder what happens behind teaching, what goes into hospital philosophies about what Tara was talking about, especially when they can be kind of subjective calls based on heart rate monitors or other things that doctors and nurses are monitoring.
Sure. I think you brought up a good point that a big part, I think, of the indication for C-sections is this sort of failure to progress diagnosis, that the labor is sort of taking too long. And when I started practicing 25 years ago, there was this rough estimation that a mom should dilate, you know, a centimeter every 1 to 2 hours, depending on how many children she'd had. Pushing should last no longer than 2 to 3 hours. There was very a little bit random numbers that were associated with effective labors. And we all knew that someone we'd say, oh, you know, the labor's not progressing, but we had another C-section, so we'll have her wait, we'll do her second. Then we'd go back and check the patient, and she wouldn't have progressed over several hours. But then while we were waiting, delayed for some other reason, she had progressed. Or someone who really insisted on wanting to continue to push longer, change positions, et cetera, would deliver successfully vaginally. So I think that's what the part of the push for ACOG has been, to really relax those numbers, that everybody's labor is different and some people take longer, but if the baby looks reassuring on the monitor, if the mom is comfortable, you know, she's doing okay, we really try to wait till it's been many hours without any dilation before we throw in the towel. Having said that, there are many patients, like oftentimes here at Northwestern where we're really busy, patients will say, please, I'm done. Can I just have a C-section? And our job is to be sort of the cheerleader for vaginal deliveries. No, you're okay. Let's give it time. And I feel like I say a million times a day, it's worth this, baby will be worth the wait. You can do it. Or, you know, let's give it till whatever time, till 2 p.m. or give it a set time so that she knows we're not going to wait forever, but we could be more patient. So ACOG has had some guidelines to really relax that it's okay if things aren't progressing as fast as it might, that if the whole rest of the labor is reassuring, that we can be patient. The other thing that's dependent on the institution is vacuum or forceps. So many women, they're exhausted for a variety of reasons. It's taking longer to push, and the baby might be making some progress, but not delivering as fast as you might think. And one of the great ways to allow a vaginal delivery is to either do forceps or vacuum, which is a way that we sort of help guide the baby out as she's pushing. Thankfully, here at Northwestern, we do lots of forceps and vaginal vacuum deliveries to help women deliver vaginally. But some institutions aren't used to doing that. The folks aren't comfortable doing that. And so if that woman's been pushing a long time and she hasn't delivered, the choice would be C-section. So
I see. Mm-hmm.
We could do better teaching, you know, making sure everyone sort of feels comfortable enough to be able to do a delivery that way.
Right. So you also, as you mentioned, you teach at the Feinberg School of Medicine, practicing
right.
At Northwestern Memorial Hospital. So, for example, at a huge hospital like Northwestern, I also always wonder if there's a tendency, and I think people who are, you know, I know in the birthing community, there's a lot of, I guess, emotion around natural delivery versus,
sure.
You know, there's a lot of different aspects of like home birthing and all of these other things. And I think there might be a thought that hospitals push for C-sections and do it early just because they're worried about the health of the baby and the mother and for malpractice or other reasons. Do you think that's a pressure that exists at hospitals?
I do. I definitely think so. Although that wouldn't really explain why it's different hospital to hospital, but truly, and that's unfortunately the way of our system, that obstetricians very rarely get sued for doing a C-section, but you get sued for not. So for some providers, I mean, unfortunately, most obstetricians will have experience being sued over the course of their career, which is unfortunate and for another discussion, but that can drive providers to say, you know what, I can't wait. You know, I think this is going to end up in a C-section, or just to make that decision call perhaps a little bit sooner. And I think that's worth women could see if to find out the C-section rate of their provider, how much experience that person has, if they trained at a high volume place, which actually is really good because then they've seen a lot and are comfortable with a variety of things that can happen in labor. But I do think that malpractice, unfortunately, can be a factor for some obstetricians as they care for a woman in labor.
So, Tara, what are some things, based on your reporting, what are some things that you advise that women can do to avoid an unnecessary C-section? It sounds like there's a lot of education that also that families need to have before they need to be educated with before they go into the hospital.
We have a section on the Consumer Reports article that addresses exactly that, how to reduce your risk. We're careful not to say how to absolutely avoid it, because you can't ever avoid a C-section. Like, you can't guarantee that you're going to avoid a C-section. Emergencies happen. But you can reduce the likelihood that you'll end up with an unnecessary one. And that's with the caveat that determining what's quote-unquote unnecessary is very, very difficult. There's no special formula for that. One is to find out where you're going to deliver, because the hospital's culture makes such a, it can, they've actually found in research that the same providers who would deliver at different hospitals have different rates at different hospitals. So the same provider will have a higher rate at the hospital with a higher rate, but a lower rate at the hospital with a lower rate. And that's not necessarily on the doctor. It often has to do with how the workflow goes. If the labor floor is set up in such a way that the hospital is not efficiently dealing with, say, a sudden influx of women in labor and they literally need beds, that may speed things up because they don't have, quality control indicators in place to address that issue. So looking at the hospitals is one way, looking at your provider and talking with your provider and making sure that your provider understands what your values are, that you know how they operate and what their thresholds are for risk. Consider using a midwife if you do have a low-risk pregnancy. Midwives are associated with lower C-section rates and tend to give more, I can't say to give more personalized attention. It's a different type of attention. You want to look for certified nurse midwives who have the full certification. Don't come in too early when you're in labor. You may be sent back home if you do come in too early. And just like the doctor was saying, don't rush to push that labor. Even when it's hard and you're in the midst of it and you're pushing, and I've had two kids, I know what that's like. Really realizing that the risks of C-sections aren't so much the immediate risks. It's not that you will have a longer recovery time and you may have more pain, but the real risks of a C-section are downstream issues with your second child or your third child, because then you're much more likely to have C-sections with those, and each additional C-section is going to increase various complication risks.
Yeah, I wonder, Dr. Quinlan, can you weigh in on what kind of complications women need to be concerned about?
Truthfully, the surgical risks of a very first C-section are, it is certainly major surgery with anesthesia and blood loss and that sort of thing. But the biggest risk for the first C-section is the second C-section. So, and that's why the ACOG, a lot of our documents say avoiding the first. If a woman has a vaginal delivery first time, the chance of her having a vaginal second time is great. She will push a shorter time. It will be much easier the second labor. The main risk of C-section is in the next pregnancy. So it's really acceptable and encouraged for women who've had one C-section to try for a vaginal delivery the second time, depending on the circumstances. But she has a small risk of that scar rupturing, of opening when she's in labor the next time. If she has a second C-section, the risk of that surgery is greater. She has scar tissue. The placenta can implant on the scar in the uterus that can cause significant problems. And it just gets worse each C-section. So if someone's hoping for four kids and has four C-sections, that can get really risky by that third and fourth, even the second. So
you really just want to try to do a C-section once, it sounds like, is your kind of, from a medical standpoint, that's kind of the goal.
The risk goes up at three, but the risk goes so down so much when someone's had a successful vaginal delivery that, like, for example, if we have to do forceps, if someone's exhausted from pushing or the baby's heartbeat is concerning, but the head is right there and we just need to guide the head out with forceps, that risk to the baby is very low, and her next baby will be so much easier because she's already delivered vaginally.
Dr. Quinlan, we just have about a minute left. I wonder what tips you have for families who are probably thinking about this right now. What advice do you have for them to prepare?
I think what was said already to understand this is going to take a long that labor can take a while, and everybody has a friend who like labored for 6 hours and pushed for 30 minutes, and that's freaky. I would say that's like the woman who wears
and
her
then everyone has the friend who labored for 26 hours as well.
Right. So, and there's someone in between. So like big picture, how are you? How is the baby? If everybody's fine, let's be patient. And I agree. I tell my patients always to stay home as long as you can. You're much more likely to have a vaginal delivery if you come in at 5 centimeters, the head is really well engaged. If you want an epidural, you can do that then, get comfortable, you know, have some rest before the time of pushing. But certainly coming in later in labor is helpful. And I think for couples to try to be patient themselves, it's so tempting to say, can I just be done? I just want a C-section. And for an obstetrician, you know, might say, okay, let's just move to that. But I think we also are influenced by our patients saying, no, I'm really hoping for vaginal delivery. Can we wait another hour? Can you tell me how you're thinking about this? And sometimes the heart rate is really concerning. The baby's in distress and will not do well if we don't deliver the baby soon, in which case a C-section is needed. But there are many points in labor that are should be really discussed between the woman and her provider about how are things going and how we should progress from there.
That's Dr. Maura Quinlan. She's the Illinois chair of ACOG, as we've been hearing, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. She's also an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Northwestern's Feinberg School of Medicine. I want to thank Tara Haley as well. The reporter behind this Consumer Report story will tweet out the link so everyone can see all that data about Illinois. Dr. Quinlan, Tara, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Sure. My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, showing and preserving significant collections and digitally archiving irreplaceable information so that it is forever accessible to students, faculty, and the community at large. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Sarah Ladipo-Manyika is a novelist and essayist who stands at the intersection of different cultures. She was raised in Nigeria and has lived in Kenya, England, and France, and currently is in San Francisco, where she teaches literature at San Francisco State University. Her latest work is a novella called Like a Mule, Bringing Ice Cream to the Sun. Its main character is a woman of a certain age and the very colorful life she leads, or at least is trying to. Sarah is going to be in Chicago speaking at Women and Children First Bookstore on Thursday. She's on the line with us now from California. Sarah, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much. Hi.
Hi. The main character of this story is a 70-something-year-old woman. Her name is Dr. Mariah Da Silva. She's a very healthy, independent, active Nigerian woman living in San Francisco. I love that she wears hot pink bras. you've said in the past that you've met many older women who've lived colorful lives, but there aren't many fictional stories about them, especially if they're Black women. And I wonder, right, was the character of Dr. Da Silva inspired by any women in particular that you've met?
Her character was inspired by many women, and I think in a way that was part of the point, that I was finding so many interesting, flamboyant, older women in real life, but I wasn't seeing them on the page. I always paraphrase Toni Morrison when she says, if there are stories that you want to read but you can't find them, then you must write them. So my main character is not after one particular person, but she was certainly inspired by many people.
I've never read a book about an aging lady that includes a frank discussion of her sexuality. Why was that an important part of this story?
Well, I think, again, I had read many stories about older men, great writers like Philip Roth and Ian McEwan and so forth, who have written about older characters who are very sensual and so forth, men, but not women. And in real life, my experience was that, you know, older women could be just as sensual, just as playful, but these were just stories that I wasn't finding on the page. And so to have an older Nigerian woman who is living in a hip, young, technology-savvy San Francisco and who is vibrant and flamboyant, as you said, you know, she'll go out for early morning walks and she'll talk to her eclectic group of friends, also characters that perhaps people haven't seen in literature, so shopkeepers, there's a homeless woman who's a friend of hers, and, you know, she has this very poised, proper English accent, Nigerian, with touches of a Nigerian accent there as well. And she'll talk about her life and this, you know, very colorful life that she's led prior to coming to San Francisco. She was an ambassador's wife. And so when she talks about going to Buckingham Palace or meeting Mrs. Gandhi, these are not exaggerations. And she also, you know, she goes for her walks, but she also loves to drive. And she has a very fancy sports car that she spent a lot of money on. And all of this, I think, just underscores her fiercely independent streak and her desire to live life to the fullest, which, of course, is threatened when she has a fall. But it doesn't stop her from being this larger-than-life character, and these characters exist in real life.
And Sarah, that scenario, I'll be honest with you, I feel like every time I go into a retirement community, I think about the scenario that Mariah's in, where she falls and she ends up in this home where people are so much worse off than she is, particularly mentally. And I kind of feel like that's probably everyone's worst nightmare of aging. I don't, is that something you've thought a lot about?
It is, absolutely. And, you know, one of my older friends who was a source of inspiration for this particular book was someone who was in her late 80s and had Parkinson's disease and then Parkinson's related dementia. And, you know, of course, that's really difficult, really awful, and, you know, a personal fear of mine. And I think in a sense, I was writing this story, sort of rewriting the end of her life, as it were, with a more upbeat note, particularly addressing that. Yes. It's old age, you know, as my character says, quoting Philip Roth, can be a massacre.
And so there's a lovely scene when she's in the dining hall where she transports herself in her head. It was a fascinating thing for me to read because on the one hand, there's the reality of the situation where she gets dressed to go to dinner and realizes that none of her lovely clothes are with her because the bag that they packed that someone grabbed to take with her to this place was not really meant for traveling. And so then she sort of just decides in her head she's going to put on another outfit. And then So there's this juxtaposition of the reality that she's in. And did you meant that scene to sort of just be like a daydream for her?
You know, she doesn't see it as a daydream. She's just living as she has led. And if I recall that scene, she's playing some music in her head. She likes to get dressed up, always has. And so she just continues that. And, you know, I think, you know, going back to something you were saying earlier, when I started to write the story, I thought I wanted to make my character 80. And people that I discussed it with said, oh, no, you can't do that. You know, she's too flamboyant and too sensuous for a woman at 80.
For an 80-year-old, too sensuous.
The funny thing is, as soon as I finished writing the book, and this was just a few months ago, I met a woman who, just looking at her, I thought she was the age of my main character. And we started to talk, and she mentioned going back to college or going back to an old college for a 75th reunion. And I thought I'd misheard her. But then I said, how old are you? And she said, I'm 96 going on 97.
Oh, my.
And she is just, I mean, she's obviously an outlier, and so she's very fit and she walks and she swims, or she's been trying to swim all her life. She still doesn't know how to swim, but she continues to take swimming lessons. But she just has this great spirit. And, you know, I said to her, I'd love to write your story, your real story. And she said, oh, honey, I have too many secrets. You know, including the fact that she has a man friend who doesn't know how old she is. So, you know, this sort of playfulness, great, the sensuality and so forth, that was really exciting for me to see. You know, here she is making my main character look like a baby. So.
And I wonder how much to her flamboyance, her energy, how much of that you think is cultural? Because I'm interested in sort of the juxtaposition of what we have in this country, sort of an American notion of aging versus maybe, you know, her, Dr. Da Silva Mariah's perspective as a Nigerian woman who's lived all over the world and in San Francisco. I even wonder if it's different perhaps in cities than it is in the U.S. compared to rural areas, sort of a concept of what aging is.
Yeah, I think for her it's both cultural and it's also a personality thing for her. I think she comes from Nigeria, so she's grown up in a culture that has for a long time, as with all cultures around the world, held old age up with some, seen older people as being wise, as a certain amount of reverence for old age. And so I think this is one of the things I was really interested in exploring, because she's now living in a society that's quite young, or that certainly values youth over age. And how does she negotiate that? And how does she, you know, hold on to what she has grown up with? And, you know, this has a personal relevance for me. I look at my father, who just turned 80, and he, you know, every decade, new decade that he turns, he's so excited. You know, he's excited about getting, he lives in London, so excited about getting his free bus pass when he was, I don't know, 60 or 70. And, you know, it's a celebration, and definitely coming from a culture that celebrates each new milestone and doesn't have the same fear. You know, again, I don't want to idealize cultures or say that cultures remain static or that everyone thinks the same, but certainly there is a difference between how older people are treated and perceived in other cultures in comparison, I think, to the way that you'll find it in many parts of America.
Sarah, you were actually shortlisted for the Goldsmith Prize last year for this novella.
I'm not sure about this, actually, but I think it was the first time that at least an African woman, I'm not sure if it was a black woman, but an African woman had been shortlisted for the prize.
Congratulations.
But it was much more than that. It was an exciting prize for me to be shortlisted for, because I had been a bit bolder with this, experimenting in terms of the length. Often people say don't write novellas because they don't sell. Experimenting in terms of content, writing about a character that's not featured, as we've discussed, a black woman, older black woman, and writing in multiple first persons. So it was really fun to be shortlisted for that prize and be amongst some many writers that I've admired.
Well, and as you say that, I can't help but think of one relationship in the book between this gentleman named Reggie, whose wife is at the home with advanced stages of dementia, and Mariah. How did that relationship come about? Did you intend that relationship would end up in the book, or did that just happen as you started writing?
That was a case of something surprising me when I put my character in that situation and began to imagine who she might meet and what sort of characters she might meet. I did have a student a few years ago who had a partner who was sick and just beginning to have the first signs of dementia. And I remember talking to her about her decision. I think she was about 80 at the time, her decision not to move into a home with her partner. And I just remembered how difficult it is for any partner who has another partner who's beginning to show signs of dementia. But, you know, what does that mean for the relationship? What does that mean for love and so forth? So I think that was probably in the back of my mind as I began to think about the character of Reggie.
And then she also has this lovely relationship with this younger Indian woman named Sunshine. How did you imagine they met?
Yes. Well, I imagined her, you know, meeting this woman in the apartment where she lived, and I imagined this woman, as you said, she's of Indian heritage, so she's familiar with different cultural approaches to aging, and I just imagined the two of them would strike up a friendship, that they would be each would have something that they would bring to the other. And without giving away too much of the plot, you know, one of the younger women trying to be of help to Mariah when she has a fall and is taken to a recuperation home, it actually doesn't help her. So there I was also exploring misunderstandings, and we think we're helping people, but we might not be helping people by organizing their lives in ways that the particular person doesn't want. So, yeah.
Speaking of organization, I love the idea of arranging books. This happens in the novella, not by alphabet or by the color of their spine, but by the idea of which characters should be talking to each
right.
other. Do you do that?
Yeah. I have to admit, I do that. I will finish a story and I'll think, oh, I would have ended it in a different way, or I wonder what would have happened if such and such a thing had happened. And I'll often look at my books on the shelves and I will imagine what kind of conversations the characters in the books have with each other. So, yes, that is quite an autobiographical element of the book.
There's also, speaking of books, a great list you have of authors that Mariah provides for a chef at the home, where she kind of comes up with a reading list for him, this young African-American, where she includes not just sort of kind of like the canon you'd think of, right? Like James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison, but C.L.R. James. I wonder what would be in your essential book list for young Black people in this country.
Well, just off the top of my head, Toni Morrison, for sure. I love the way that she writes for the ear, and I love the way that she has essentially, she's written the American story from a perspective that it was never really written before her. I think she's just been very groundbreaking in that sense. So definitely Toni Morrison. I would recommend all sorts of writers. Mohsen Hamid is one writer that I've enjoyed reading recently. I love the length of his books. They are sort of novella length, which is, I love the idea of reading a book in a day or so, which is something that I try to do with my book, the latest book. Yemisi Arabisala is a really exciting new writer. She's written a book entitled Soup, Sex, and Nigerian Taste Buds. And Long Throat Memoirs, Soup, Sex, and Nigerian Taste Buds. I would definitely say Baldwin, though.
Sure.
You know, Baldwin is a go-to all the time.
Mm-hmm. Last question for you, Sarah. I wonder what you think, as I was reading this, one of the things that the producers and I were talking about was what you think might be missing in terms of portrayals of Black women, specifically African women, whether we're talking about British or American writing about them?
In terms of what's, I think there are so many stories, and for me, this excites me. There are so many stories that haven't been told about whether it's African American women or it's African women living in different parts of America, living in different parts of the world. Women from different socioeconomic backgrounds, different sexualities, different ages. I mean, so I see it, at least for a writer, as something really exciting, that there is so much to write. I mean, one often hears people saying, oh, you know, every story has been written, but I disagree with that. I think all themes and ideas, you know, people have always written about love and death and struggle and depression and so forth, but the actual characters, where people come from and, you know, from different cultures and different ethnicities and so forth, those stories haven't all been written.
Sarah Laripo Manica's latest novella is called Like a Mule Bringing Ice Cream to the Sun. If you're in the Chicago area, you can catch her this Thursday at 7:30 at Women and Children First Bookstore. Sarah, thanks for being with me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. So much fun. Thanks.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As always, on Mondays, we discuss the latest in Illinois politics. This week, Governor Rauner is accused of leaking bad numbers on school spending. Democrats are going on the offensive in the governor's race. And 691 days with no budget still counting. To talk about all of this, the Illinois Playbook political reporter Natasha Korecki is with us. She's on the line from Chicago. Hey, Natasha, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So we're about a week and a half away from the next deadline to pass a state budget. If anyone's keeping track, right, Natasha, lots of different people are 691 days since Illinois has had a state budget.
Yeah, now we do have lots of different clocks going on. If you look at the front page of the Sun-Times, every day they're going to post the number of days that we've gone without a budget. As we reported this morning, J.B. Pritzker, Democratic candidate for governor, has launched a new website where it's a giant clock running it out and to show how many days we've gone without a budget.
Right. So, yeah, Natasha, that's the crisis-creating Rauner website. Is that what that's the name? Is that the actual link to the site?
That's right.
And how much of this, obviously, this is a difficult question thinking about the election, 2018, but how much do you think you're seeing Democratic candidates use the state budget crisis right now to sort of start a conversation about the race?
You know, I actually thought last week, I was just thinking, wow, they're really not hammering Rauner the way that Rauner was hammering Pat Quinn back in 2014. So this actually... to me, is a little bit of a change. I mean, yeah, they're all mentioning it and they're talking about it and it's part of their campaigns. But if you recall back in 2014 when Quinn was fighting with Madigan, Rauner was every day, just hammering Quinn, saying he was ineffective. He was failed leadership. He could not produce a balanced budget. He didn't know how to negotiate, and Rauner said, I'm a businessman. I can negotiate. I would lock myself in Springfield until I got that budget done. So to me, it's with great irony that we are now here yet with this new governor. So J.B. Pritzker now is kind of filling that void. And at least that's what he's promising to do with this new sort of campaign, this website, which will be paired with social media.
Right. And all of this, of course, to... really try to draw attention to the budget situation. I wanted to ask you somewhat differently, Natasha, the other kind of big story that's been going on late last week, there's been this big battle between Senator Andy Menar, a Democrat, accusing Governor Rauner's office of leaking false numbers on school funding to media outlets. This is media outlets linked to Dan Proft, one of Rauner's political allies. I wanted to just play a little bit of Senator Menar on Friday.
They complain about me not negotiating good faith, and at the same time, they're cooking up numbers and documents and sending them over to the campaign apparatus in order to kill a bill.
That's Democrat Senator Andy Menar. Natasha, you've been following the story. You've been speaking to Senator Menar. Can you tell us what's going on here?
Well, so from Senator Menar's standpoint, he passed a bill on Wednesday. It was a state funding bill. From his standpoint, it holds everybody in the state at the same level of funding. That means no one's going down, and it helps get funding for those who are the neediest in the district, so they will get more money under this bill. From his standpoint, right? So after he passes the bill, he goes to the governor's office for a session. He says that the governor's office has a giant draft analysis on the screen of his bill, and it shows all these numbers that are incorrect. And he is arguing with them and saying, hey, this is not right. Fast forward, he gets home, about a couple hours later, and what he believes he saw in the governor's office is now in one of Dan Prof's publications.
And we should explain to everybody, right, these
Times, yeah. It says, you know, analysis, according to an analysis obtained by Kankakee Times from the Illinois State Board of Education. So Menard goes through the roof because he has not received an analysis himself from the Illinois State Board of Education. And here is one of Dan Prof's papers saying they have it. So that's where this all starts. And he just goes crazy because he believes that the governor's office is trying to provide political cover to Republicans who voted against Menard's bill to say that their districts are going to lose money, when in reality Menard says they are not going to lose money. And so much happens on Friday, which is, you know, Dan Prof is producing emails saying, hey, we didn't really get this. This wasn't, you know, secret information we received. This was something we got from Reboot Illinois 1 year ago. It's all very convoluted. And
the governor's office now, right. And Natasha, what's the governor's office been? Because there was a statement that was put out yesterday. There's just been this whole back and forth all weekend about this.
Right. So they say they accuse Annie Menard of jumping the shark, as they said, and saying that this is a completely outrageous allegation. It's false. They asked him to apologize. And Menard's not backing down. I mean, we talked to Menard last night, and he's quite the opposite, saying if Governor Browner and Education Secretary Beth Purvis really want to negotiate with us, they would tell Dan Prof to correct the numbers, which are now in several of his publications, indicating that all these districts are going to lose money when they're not going to lose money. So
right.
He thinks that there's a coordinated effort by this political apparatus of the governor to kind of smear this bill.
And just to be clear, Natasha, those community papers, can you explain a little bit more? Because there's been some controversy about those papers in the past, making it
right.
seem as,
I
yeah.
Mean, so originally, the original papers that were started were with Dan Prof, and they were funded by Liberty Principles, which is a super PAC. And Bruce Rauner and Ken Griffin have given millions of dollars to Liberty Principles. So there's a lot of controversy with these papers, and you know they take a very pro-Rauner stand. They're not considered real journalism, you know, by many people in the community. They're reporters who do not live in Illinois. They're in other states.
But they look like community papers. Like, they look like a local paper.
Well, that is the thing, that if you are an average person who is just Googling something, you think that it's a legitimate news site. You don't know what it is. So if you're just like Googling your local school district and you see this come up, you're going to think, oh my gosh, my school district's going to lose all this money. And it's run by Dan Prof, who is a very, you know, political stance. He's taken money from Rauner. He says he's taking these things private now, that they're not connected to his money anymore. But the fact of the matter is, he is, you know, an agent of Bruce Rauner, right? So, you know, there's still that cloud hanging over it. And if you look at any of these newspapers, quote-unquote newspapers, they're just very, you know, they'll have the center story will be like a very anti-Madigan story, or they're just very, you know, one-sided. It's not a traditional newspaper in that
right.
sense.
It's not a traditional in terms of a unbiased or independent. Natasha, what do you think all of this says now about tensions between Illinois Democrats and Republicans? I don't even know where. I mean, I keep thinking, can we get to a lower point?
I know. And do you think that the two sides are getting together and they're going to come up with something? You know, the Republicans say that the Democrats called the education bill before the Republicans were ready for it. But I think what all this shows is that there's such an incredible amount of distrust on both sides. You know, they are just not ready to believe each other. They think one is willing to sabotage the other just for political gain. And, you know, I think it doesn't help that there is this governor's race in the backdrop, and there's all these commercials starting. There's, you know, on the day of one of the big grand bargain votes, Ken Griffin moves $20 million into Governor Rauner's campaign account. So it's very,
Just say that number again, Natasha. Say that number again. How much money?
$20 million into Governor Rauner's campaign account. This was on the day of the grand bargain vote. And, of course, you know, you have on the other side, you have a billionaire, J.B. Pritzker, running for governor and airing ads already. So there's just the campaign is always there, and it's always in everyone's in their minds. So it's really hard to govern when you're worried about politics.
And speaking of that, you mentioned the grand bargain. I wanted to talk about that for a minute. That was Wednesday of last week, Illinois Democrats beginning to push individual pieces of the so-called grand bargain through the Senate. That's, of course, that package plan that Democrats and Republicans were hoping to work together on, but there were no Republicans who voted for the Democrats' grand bargain proposal. And in fact, here's Republican Senator Jason Barrickman from Bloomington.
What happened today was a political show orchestrated by the Democrats who are trying to portray agreements that do not yet exist.
Again, that's Bloomington State Senator Jason Barrickman. Natasha, I mean, where are we at with these, you know, Democrats? It's sort of like Democrats, it just sort of seems like, is everything kind of completely fallen apart? What's going on?
It hasn't completely fallen apart yet, but it sure seems like we're headed in that direction. I mean, the Republicans say that the Democrats jumped the gun by calling some of this stuff, but the Democrats, from their standpoint, they've been calling these things since January and still cannot. They're like, hey, we have less than 2 weeks left. This has to go to the House still. So it's a really tall order. There's a ton of distrust. I think we're headed for another short-term spending plan. Just with the level of acrimony in Springfield, the level of distrust between Republicans and you know, the only people who were negotiating were the Senate Republicans and the Senate Democrats, and now they are in this epic fight. So I just don't see a lot of this getting smoothed over before May 31st, which is
right. The
deadline for a budget.
Right, right. Let's just switch topics to one other thing. This morning, the Chicago Tribune editorial board blasted at Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan, saying she's compromised, she's incomplete. Lots of pretty harsh words for Lisa Madigan. Wonder where you saw that coming from, or why you think some. Yeah, go ahead.
It was a really interesting editorial. I think the timing of it was because she just announced she was going to run for a record fifth
right.
term in
mm-hmm.
office, and without a lot of fanfare. And yeah, it is a little bit of a reflection on Lisa Madigan and you know, just all the aspirations she once had for U.S. Senate, for governor. You really saw her as this rising star, and she's just sort of remained in the same position, largely and very publicly because of her father was refusing to step down as House Speaker, and she felt she couldn't run for governor. But what the editorial really focused on was her role as Attorney General, and what they say is her inability to kind of rise to the same level as other Attorney Generals in other states and really ferreting out public corruption. They list the failure to do anything about the Frank Martino, the Auditor General, who's had all these mm-hmm. campaign finance issues, and really to jump in on lots of others. I mean, we have no shortage of corruption in Illinois, but the paper pointed out that that's usually exposed by newspapers and the U.S. Attorney's Office or watchdog groups and not by the Illinois Attorney General.
Yeah, that was a really tough line in there.
Yeah, you see in other states, in Florida, New York, and California, their attorney generals just are just much more powerful in that sense, where they're really digging into corruption. So the Tribune's point is that she just won't go there. She's too much of a party person in their view to go where she needs to go.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Natasha, we're pretty much out of time. Just wonder quickly, any predictions for the budget for next week? You just said you think nothing, maybe we'll see a short-term plan?
I think we're going to end up seeing the House do their own budget, the Senate does their own budget. It'll be like last year where, you know, neither of them pass the other chambers, and we end up coming back here in June or something and pass a stopgap budget. I don't know. And I think it really hurts Rauner. He you know, he now is going to have to run on the fact that he has not had a budget in all his years here. You know, what does he have to show for it? He's going to blame the Democrats. But ultimately, does the governor wear the jacket? I think we'll find out.
Yeah, that's Natasha Kerecki. You can see every morning her Illinois playbook. Sign up for that. We'll tweet out links. Thanks so much for being with us, Natasha. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow, Goodman Theater resident director Chuck Smith is going to be joining us to talk about Objects in the Mirror, a powerful account of one refugee's journey from Liberia to Australia. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every way to contact us is at our website. That's 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. We're broadcasting today from the Medill Newsroom in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.